that may be, as we kind of stated last week, a little bit of a sign that a lot of the negative view has been already priced into the current market pricing, and as we're now receiving it, the market's kind of taking it in and then shrugging it off. So we like that as the markets try to move forward. EAFE and the emerging markets had good weeks this week. They were up 7% and almost 10% each. They've been kind of a laggard for a while, but it was nice to see that the emerging market and international arena finally found some footing and had some gains. Dow was basically flat for the week. S&P was up just fractionally, so not a lot of gains there. But sometimes those are the little victories are what we're looking for. We saw some pretty good pops down in the sector. Basic materials up 11%. Internet gained by about 11%. Semiconductors up 10%. So there's a couple sectors that have been really beaten up this year, Randy, that have been able to get some performance this past week as well. So, you know, we'll continue to keep an eye on what's materializing there. I think some commodities, you know, had a jump this week. We saw oil pop up. We saw gold pop up. Basic materials. A lot of that may be just because some really oversold conditions that we've seen with the big dramatic drop-off. I know there's a lot of talk of infrastructure things going on, so that could have played a little bit into it. But I think sometimes when you get when you get commodities that sell up as hard as they did, they were due to bounce back to the upside. We'll see whether that trend is something that is sustainable. I don't think it is. I don't think you're going to see commodity prices just all of a sudden hold up and then begin to really rise rapidly. So we'll probably have a little bit of a chop there, and then maybe they'll try to work their way a little bit lower before we finally hit the bottom of commodity prices. But, you know, the damage has been done. Year-to-date numbers are ugly. I don't think those are going to get any better. 2008 is not going to magically become a decent year. It's going
to go down.
What
about the Santa Claus rally?
Yeah, you know, if we get one, it's still not going to be able to undo a lot of the damage. So 2008 is going to go down in the record books as one of the ugly years in stock market history. So we just need to prepare for that. I know we've got a lot of things that we're going to talk about later in the show that kind of deals with perspective and where we need to probably refocus ourselves and not focus so much on what has happened, but what do we got to do to move forward, both emotionally, psychologically, and with our investment accounts.
Okay. Well, we'll get to all that, and we actually have a full show this afternoon. Let's see. We had a full bowl of callers there. Where are those at, Tyler? Okay. Let's go directly to Bruce in Olathe, Kansas, actually. Bruce, welcome to The Bottom Line. How can we help you this afternoon?
I was just answering your question.
Oh, okay, let me state that again for the record here. We had all four lines lit up here, so if you're calling in with the answer again, 576-7798. Looks like we got technical difficulties on that side of the stage up here. But in any case, let's see. Senator denounces the moneyed interests of Wall Street, stating that he would not allow them to crucify mankind. One of the senators I'm going to mention here was attributed to that particular comment, and the question is who is it? Is it A, Hubert Humphrey in 1968? Is it B, Barack Obama in 2008, or was it William Bryan in 1896? What do you think?
It was William Jennings Bryan in 1896.
Democratic senator from Nebraska, 1896. We put that trivia question in there simply to help people because we did a seminar this week or a financial workshop on a kind of a timely topic. It was actually the art of investing in portfolio management. Some of the attenders actually kind of brought the question that, you know, gosh, conditions like this have never existed before. We have got, you know, crisis in every element of society today and headlines like we've never seen before. We threw that out there to simply say, well, I'm not sure that's exactly true. My question is how in the world, Bruce, did you know that it was actually Senator William Jennings Bryan? Are you a student of him?
I'm a history buff anyway.
Okay. Right. Well, you happen to be correct in this week, and you are the correct caller on that particular topic, so we're going to put you on hold. Tyler's going to get your name and address, and we're going to send you 101 Tax Savings Tip authored by our in-studio host this afternoon, Professor Randy Gardner, professor of University of Missouri, Kansas City, Tax and Finance. You could not have a better topic or a better book, I think, in your disposal to have that. So, Bruce, we hope you enjoy it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Certainly welcome, and thanks for being a bottom line listener. When we come back, we're going to actually be talking about financial topics in the news, along with your questions at 576-7798. I think the lines are back on at this point in time, so if you have questions this afternoon, 576-7798 is the number to call. You're listening to The Bottom Line here on News Radio 980 KMBZ. Welcome back to The Bottom Line. I'm your host, Randy Hellyer. Keith Elder and I are taking your calls at 576-7798. Ready to discuss any financial topic on your mind this afternoon, doesn't matter what it is, and 576-7798 is the number to call. That's what David called at Lake Winnebago, who's got a question about Roth IRAs. Dave, welcome to The Bottom Line. How can we help you?
Thank you, Randy.
Sure.
My question is, since there's been such a loss in stocks this year, if you had a loss, A stock, let's say just A stock, in an IRA account that was at a very low, could you transfer it to, and my question is twofold, to a Roth IRA or just a regular, just another account? And if you transfer it to another account, would you, what basis would could you use as what you bought it for when you finally sold it?
I got it. So basically, yeah, you own stock inside of a traditional IRA, and basically the question now is kind of twofold. Is one is could you take the loss if you transferred it, or B, is it maybe an opportunity to think about doing a Roth conversion?
Mainly the Roth conversion. Or, yeah. I mean, not the loss. I know you can't claim the loss.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, I think it's a wonderful opportunity to consider Roth conversions. The first question always is eligibility. So if you always check your income, so you've got to have your AGI below the figure, typically $100,000, I think is what we're relying on that. And then, yeah, I think there's a wonderful opportunity for conversion this year simply based on the devaluation of a lot of people's accounts. So we're generally in favor of it. We've done several. Mm-hmm. I've recommended several. We've got a few in the pipeline actually for the last couple of weeks in December as well. Keith?
Well, yeah, if you qualify and if you're able to pay the taxes from other sources, if you think this particular stock is going to rebound in value, you'd rather it rebound in value inside of a Roth environment than the existing IRA. So it's a great time to make those kinds of strategic changes, and a lot of people will probably be pursuing those types of adjustments.
Okay, one last. If you just change it to a regular account, okay, what tax basis would you have with you when you finally sold stock?
The value of the sales price.
The original sale price?
No, the one you've liquidated it for. So in other words, if you paid $100 for the stock and it's fallen to $60, and if you took the money out in the form of a distribution of the stock, or if you sold the stock or took the stock out of the IRA account itself, you'd have to use the current value.
Oh, you're right, because you would be taking it. Okay.
Sure. I think there's a couple of other things I'll just mention to you, Dave. Since a lot of people are talking about this Roth conversion, we discussed eligibility so that you can add to the income test. The second is because the values are down, it's a good time to also do it. There are two other factors we always look at when we do these real quickly, one of which is the age of the client, simply because they've got to
retired.
Have a long enough life expectancy to make it work out by paying the tax. And then the fourth item is really the ability to pay the tax from a non-IRA source. So if all those things are clicking in the right direction, I would say that it's a wonderful opportunity to consider a Roth conversion.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That's the deal.
You're welcome.
You bet. Thanks for being a bottom line listener. Let's go ahead and clear the line up, and let's take Colin. And Colin, are you calling from Bucyrus?
Bucyrus.
Did you know I used to live in Bucyrus?
Did you really?
I really did. I loved it out there. I actually lived out at 223rd Street, and I often said I thought God lived out there. It was such a wonderful place to live. I truly miss
wonderful.
It.
Yeah, I'm just south of 247th. I'm sitting in a pasture in a ranch truck, and the wind is just incredible. I hope you guys can hear me okay.
Well, you heard 40-mile-an-hour gusts, so
It's lifting the side of the truck up and rocking it around pretty good. But I had a quick investment question I never hear anybody talk about. These income funds, I've been in and out of this AllianceBernstein income fund for the past 25 years, and it pays between 7 and 11% on its yield.
Mm-hmm.
And the stock has never strayed out of between 6 and, I think, $9 a share. It's pretty consistent. Mm-hmm. And every time I got a flight to just parking my money just to get a little bit better return than a money market, I've been sticking my stuff in this thing for quite a while. Actually, there's a couple of them that I choose, and this is probably the lowest yield that it has.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when the market tanks, its yield goes up, so there's some kind of an inverse relationship, and I think it's backed by some government securities. I'm just trying to get some insight from some folks that can tell me what the heck are these things.
Sure. Yeah, I think what's going on there, and I don't know what that particular fund holds, but I'll just make a general comment that a lot of that stuff, you've got government bonds, you've got probably some investment grade corporates in there. There might even be a little bit of high yield mixed in there, and possibly those things will carry some convertible and preferred stock positions to create that income environment. And when you do, you tend to get a little bit more stability of the principal. You don't usually see a lot of growth come out of that. And you kind of mentioned that it's had its own little trade range between $6 and $9 per share over time. It kind of goes back and forth in there. That seems reasonable to me that it would be doing that. And then if you're seeing as the price drops and the yield is rising, that would tell me that there is quite a bit of bond play in there. Because that's the normal inverse relationship with bonds. As bond values go down, their yields climb, and as bond values begin to go up, and you see the yield go down, so that they work in different direction. I'll tell you, I think a lot of people will begin to try to look. Capital growth and capital appreciation has been non-existent for several years now, and I think people will begin to try to include back into their portfolio some of these types of devices that can bring in some fairly decent income yield. So that if you're not getting capital appreciation, at least you're getting some kind of return on the capital.
When should I walk away from these? Because there's three of them that I usually play with for a long time. I got one of them that's got a 60% yield, one's got 32%, and I think that can't be good. There's probably some kind of instability in there that I'm almost afraid to venture into. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know how to comment on that. I mean, I just some of that you need to look at the quality of maybe, you know, you need to open that up and see what kind of investment grade and what the ratings are of some of those positions to get a better feel of what that stuff is in there.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking too. I kind of shied away from those other two. I'm just kind of sitting them on the side right now. I got a little bit of money in each one of them, but most of my stuff's in this one I'm talking to you about. And man, I've had it for off and on for 25 years. It's done great. It's just never, you know, I guess that's what it's supposed to do is create some kind of income, but the yield's just been incredible over the past, 10 years with the thing.
Yeah, that's very common with those types of funds, and they just lost some of their popularity because they don't have a lot of the sizzle that some of the growth and capital appreciation and small cap and international funds had. Everybody was looking for that big home run type return, and so these types of funds sometimes get put on the shelf, but an astute investor like you can kind of sit back and realize, you know, there are times that income flow is a little more consistent than capital appreciation in bad market environments, so you've benefited from that.
Appreciate the explanation.
You bet.
You're welcome.
Colin, thanks for being a listener, and be careful out there.
I will. Thanks, guys.
You're certainly welcome. Let's take our next caller. It's Nick in Kansas City. Has a question about an annuity or annuity questions. Nick, welcome to the Bottom Line. How can we help?
Well, I just want to wish a Merry Christmas to both Randy and Keith. I've worked with them for many years, and their expertise has been very helpful to my family. Specifically,
Keith
suggested that we get into some fixed income annuity type products. Really about the market peak, and I'm just eternally grateful you guys. You guys have done an outstanding job.
Well, that's a great comment. There's going to be a paid endorsement or something. That's great. Did you have a specific question, or was it just a comment?
Well, it's the Christmas season, time to be thankful, and so I'm just calling to thank you, gentlemen.
That's great. Well, we appreciate that very much, and thanks for the call as well. Well, we do have some. Well, it must be the only client we have.
Only client.
That's the way it goes. Let's see. In the news this week, we have a lot of interesting things that are happening out there. The Fed announced that it will buy $600 billion of mortgage-backed securities under a new government-sponsored entities purchase program. They will, in effect, purchase mortgages from Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Ginny Mae, and Fed Home Bank. So for those of you that did not think that, in fact, there are things that are still happening out in Washington, a little gridlock out there with all the talk and discussion about what's happening with the big three automakers. In fact, there are some things happening. So this is actually going to help anytime we can get the government back into this mortgage discussion again, which we think is kind of fundamentally, you know, part of the real intrinsic problem with the base of the pyramid. So we think that's probably something we really have to focus on. So we applaud them for that. That actually, the source of that was actually in investment news this past week. The same day that the announcement that the Fed launched a new program, which is now called the Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility, they intended for this program to actually put up about $200 billion to private investors in this case, who would turn by securitized assets that are actually backing auto loans, credit card loans, student loans, and small business loans. So, again, looks like there's some liquidity headed our direction, and as a result of that, probably will help kind of unthaw some of the credit market issues that are out there as well. Keith, don't you kind of generally feel encouraged by that kind of information?
Well, I think so. I mean, I know what they're trying to reinstill confidence, Randy, and if you feel you get some government guarantee kind of behind some of these things, then I think people feel a little bit more, you know, stable and going ahead and doing that kind of business or stepping back into that area. So I think we're going to continue to see programs come out that are attempting to address that. You know, liquidity, as I said last week, there's plenty of liquidity that has been pumped into this environment. It is at a point now that we've got to get confidence reinstilled. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, probably true. We want confidence out there as well. As we come up to the break, I just got the calculator this week, Keith. You know, I don't like to do that very often, but I did this week. And I started doing some calculations about the combined value of all the various proposed loans and bills and bailouts and tax incentives and warrants and guarantees that have all been announced this year, most of those obviously within the last 5 months or so. And if my calculator's hopefully it rounded correctly here, but I think that basically what we're talking about between all of these various programs add up to about $2.588 trillion, if you basically look at all of the possible things. Now, that's probably not the final bid. We know that there's some debt structure out there that basically is now saying that perhaps we've created something in the closer to the $10 trillion range. But the truth of the matter is that that's a lot of, impetus to be pumping into the system over a relatively short period of time. When we come back from the break, we're actually going to be talking about, in our financial toolbox topic this afternoon, the idea of using fixed equity indexed annuities. It's in the news again this week. You'll find out why when you come back to The Bottom Line here on News Radio 980 KMBZ. Year-end planning, obviously, kind of still in the minds of people out there. Tax harvesting opportunities, that's been a lot in the various publications, the periodicals this particular time as well, because there apparently are some opportunities for some investors to actually take advantage of actually reaping some losses and maybe using those effectively today and maybe in future years as well. So I have to think about that. I want to make an announcement. We mentioned this last week. We had a number of callers that call in for our new free DVD entitled Taking Control of Your Financial Future. The firm invested in creating a relatively short DVD that talks about the holistic planning process. It's the idea, listeners, of actually retaining a firm to work on your behalf that for about the same price that you may be paying to actually have someone just sell investments to you, is really having your estate plan done, tax planning and preparation completed, completion of a comprehensive financial plan, as well as the ability to have professionals assess most of the financial areas of your life. That's really what we call holistic financial planning. And if you're interested in learning more about how that takes place, we're going to encourage you to call a number. You can call them right now, as a matter of fact, and you will receive free of charge. There's no cost or obligation associated with this offer. A free DVD, you just put it in your computer, your desktop, your laptop, and boot it up. And within less than 5 minutes or so, you'll learn more about what holistic planning really looks like. The number to call is 913-742-7700. That's 742-7700. You would call that and receive a free copy of the DVD that talks about taking control of your financial future. So if you'd like to learn more about that, that would be the number to call, 742-7700. And we'll be glad to send that out next week. And you can actually review that information in the privacy of your own home. As we typically do in the financial toolbox segment of this discussion, is to talk about various tools and products that are used in the profession of finance to help people accomplish their financial goals. Sometimes those tools can be effectively used, and sometimes people apply the wrong tool to the wrong job and end up with mixed results, of course, so things are potentially problematic in that area. In the news this week, from securities regulators are now sounding the bell again on abusive sale practices around one of the very typical topics out there. In this particular case, it is fixed equity indexed annuities, and that's making news apparently all over the country. Of course, Keith, in this type of a market condition, you would expect probably a lot of people, you know, seniors, retirees, others that are pre-retired, basically looking at investment accounts, being discouraged or dismayed about market results. As a result of that, they're confused about what to do, and sometimes they begin looking for other solutions. Solutions that hopefully, in some cases, sound a little too good to be true, but the question is finding out specifically what they do. In this particular case, here's a fact that was quoted recently by the Securities and Exchange Commission. On average, 45% of all consumer complaints revolve specifically around the topic we're discussing today, and in some states, it's reached as high as 65%. So if you can imagine, out of all the possible things that can go wrong in the financial services industry between reps and clients, two-thirds of them revolve around one specific topic. That has really gotten a lot of attention out there. And in this particular case, it's about the inappropriate use, unfortunately, of annuity products. More interestingly than that, they are now saying that specifically marketing firms are clearly targeting single females age 65 and over. Most of us know in this age of privacy, or in some cases lack thereof, demographical information is readily available, and as a result of that, they tend to end up on these mailing lists, the call list, and things of this nature. According to the article, the pitch is almost always the same, something to the tune of 4% to 12% guaranteed returns, no stock market risk, and that seems to be the call that is causing people to probably look a little bit closer. Of course, in the complaints, we find that the details are apparently either not being fully or sufficiently explained, or if they are being provided, it is in a document form that probably would be, I guess, kind of referred to as the fine print. So as we discuss this topic, if you've got questions about the use of these products or you've been actually been asked to consider the use of one of these products, you can give us a call at 576-7798. Keith, with the listeners in mind, let's talk just basically, number one, about what an annuity contract is and what its primary purpose or application may be in financial planning or building a portfolio for a client.
Yeah, in simplest terms, I mean, annuities are a contract that's issued between you and the insurance company. So, I mean, that's first and foremost. They're not issued by banks or other institutions of that nature. So you're entering into a contract with an insurance company. There's a variety of annuities. This particular article was really focusing on the index annuity, which again has gotten a lot of traction simply because of the way that it's touted that you can get stock market like returns without having to have stock market like risk. And as that begins to kind of play out more and more, people are finding out that's probably just not the case. Because they really aren't structured to give you stock market-like returns. They allow you to participate in the stock market, but between all the caps and things that go on, it just doesn't play out that way. So, but you are going to enter a contract, and in that contract, there's going to be a lot of details. In this particular kind of product, Randy, you're going to have a lot of formulas that are driven on how your rate of return will be calculated. And then there are a ton of formulas in this particular industry, which makes it all that more confusing for the consumer to really figure out what they've got. In there also, you'll have terms as far as how long the contract exists. Do you have surrender charges? How long the surrender charges are and the amounts of those. In many cases, Randy, those surrender charges are extremely high and extend out for many, many years. So you've got to be aware of that. And again, some of that is kind of glazed over very quickly, and people don't really realize that. Sometimes you're required to annuitize in order to even get access to some of the gains and performance that have happened in some of these contracts. Others will give you minimal withdrawal privileges, usually up to maybe 10% a year. But there's a lot of formulas that go into that that makes it a very complex product. And I think that in the hands of the wrong people, and apparently this article is bearing that out, a lot of noise and minutia is being sold to people, and by the time they get into it, figure out that it's not exactly what they thought, it's too late, and they find themselves in a very disgruntled position.
Well, to be clear, I mean, on probably each side of any issue is obviously there's pros and cons, and there is certainly the reason these products exist is apparently there's a market for them, and number two, they may be or will be appropriate for some percentage of a person's overarching portfolio in and of themselves, and we're certainly drawing attention to that. It's really just another tool to be used. So before we get into some of the dark sides here, the question is that when might it be appropriate and under what circumstances would it be appropriate to consider using this type of a product for some portion of a person's, especially retirement, account?
Well, simply if you're a risk-averse investor, because some of the guarantees that do come with these contracts where you don't have any downside movement in your principal, that makes a lot of sense. But the minute you hear that, you've got to understand that the upside return cannot be something in the, 10, 12, 13% range. It's just not going to happen on a regular basis. So it does serve a role to stabilize a portfolio, to possibly give you, I think you're going to look between, maybe 4 to 6% average rate of return, Randy, would come out of those products over time when you apply all the formulas. So that's, very equivalent to what people normally get out of bond positions, although we know bonds can be volatile and you can have price movement. So with these products, you don't get that price movement. But if you get the same kind of yield return, then maybe you've brought stability and managed some risk. I think that's when they're probably most appropriate. But again, I hate the fact that they're trying to connect it. Look, the returns that you get are hinged upon what the stock market does, but you aren't going to get the stock market's returns. It's just not going to happen.
One of the things that the article brought out is that this is probably not being very well explained, or if it is, it's certainly being perhaps overlooked, that when you're buying an index product, in most cases what they're doing is that they're using an index, and we'll just use an example because there's certainly many that could be used, but the S&P 500 is probably most commonly spoken of.
Right.
But if you read the contract, it says that basically you get a participation rate, and that participation rate may be anywhere from 50% up to perhaps as much as 90% or even more. But then when you read it, it says that it's based on the price movement of the S&P 500. Now, how could that be, I guess, a bad thing?
Well, the price movement, a lot of times, right, sometimes it's a point-to-point. I mean, they may start you on January 1, as an example, and measure it to the next January 1, and whatever the change in the S&P value was, you're going to get a percentage of that. A lot of them, though, actually use an averaging. So they take what the S&P did every single month for, say, 12 months, they add those together and average it out, and that's what you get. So it's not really the change in value by the S&P, but what it averaged. So, I mean, there's a lot of forms, a lot of different point-to-points, a lot of averaging that goes on. But you get the participation rate, you get caps, you know, it's 100% participation, but we cap you off that you can't make any more than 7%. I mean, you have to read all the fine print and all the formula and just understand the product is designed to, I mean, the insurance company is not out there taking that money and putting it on the stock market and having it heavily invested that way. They've got it in a more secure investment environment because they have guarantees they have to make on this money. Right. They're just using the stock market as a tool to determine what kind of rate of return they're going to pay to you. And they also, most of these contracts, Randy, have the ability every year on your anniversary to adjust the formula components, and they're going to adjust those formulas so that if you've had this contract for, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10 years, when it's all said and done, it's highly unlikely that you will have earned much more than 4, 5, 6% when it's all said and done. They're just not going to be able to pay out high rates of returns because they're not investing in a high rate environment, and that's where the disgruntled people are looking and think, well, I expected this, but I'm not getting that, and now I've got all these surrender charges that I would have to pay if I wanted to get out, mm-hmm. and that's where they're trying to really get this thing cleaned up.
We'll talk about a couple of more points on their topic this afternoon in the Financial Toolbox is the utilization of fixed equity indexed annuities. We'll do that along with your calls at 576-7798. You're listening to The Bottom Line here on News Radio 980 KMBZ. Before the break, we started talking about the topic about the utilization of fixed equity indexed annuities. It's back in the news. Again, this week we'll be talking about some of the pros and the cons, when to use them, and basically some things to certainly be aware of. One of the things that was interesting about the article that I read this past week, Keith, was the idea about the participation rates with this and the indexes that are typically used. The S&P 500 is one, the NASDAQ is certainly another, the Dow is yet another. So they have a lot of different opportunities, and as these products develop and mature over time, they continue to go through more innovations over time. But one of the things that it made clear in the article, which needs to be explained to people who are looking at these particular products, is typically the contracts are written in such a fashion that you have a participation rate, and the participation rate is based on the price change. So an easy example would be that if the S&P was the index, if you bought it and it says that the S&P did a price point change that year by 10%, then your participation rate would be that. What they did not make clear in that was the fact that that does not include the dividend. And that is a huge factor, and I give the listeners an example of this, that if you follow the S&P 500 over a long period of time, you would find out that price changes is one measure of adjustment or returns, but dividend reinvestment is obviously another. The interesting thing is that the majority of these contracts never allowed the dividend to actually be included in the return potential. Let me give you an example of what that could mean. On December 31st of 1965 through December 31st of 1981, that during that period of time, the average rate of return during that period for the S&P 500 was actually 80% of the total return came as a result of the reinvested dividend. So that's excluded from the formula. In effect, virtually 80% of all the participation itself would be eliminated from the gains in the contract. And there again, most consumers are not probably going to ask that question or pose that question, that basically their participation rate is only based on the price change of the index in which they are participating.
Yeah, historically, the dividend has been a major component of the S&P's total return. In recent years, I mean, the dividend has been less of that component, but I think that's a pendulum that will shift, and I think dividend play will be a bigger percentage of total return comes from the S&P as we move forward once again. And you're right, these particular formulas do not take that into consideration. The other thing about that is, Randy, is that the participation rate may be set at 100%. However, they have caps. If you've got 100% participation rate, I guarantee you you've also got a cap in your formula, and that cap can be adjusted every year. And normally those caps are in the, anywhere from 5, 6, 7, 8%. So even if the S&P went up 30% and you're supposed to get 100% participation, you only get it up to your cap. So if your cap's 7, you're done at 7. So the minute the S&P is anything more than 7%, you're not going to get that anyway. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot that goes into play. I'm going to make this comment. Regarding the product as a whole, and not the specifics, not the formulas, but just the product as a whole, this was created by the insurance industry for one reason. We ran into a period of time where interest rates were low, therefore their fixed annuity product, which just has a fixed interest rate that they pay you, those yields were low, they were unattractive, they weren't selling a whole lot of them. Variable annuities, which are tied directly to the investment market, when the markets got really ugly in 2001 and 02, and we saw the big sell-off, people didn't want to buy variable annuities. So all of a sudden, the insurance industry couldn't sell fixed annuities. They couldn't sell the variable annuity because of the market environment. So the equity index annuity fit right in between those two and became a big marketing gimmick on trying to get it played into investors' fear over stock market declines and yet tried to appeal to their desire to get guaranteed-like returns. And when you begin to mix all that together and it's sold inappropriately, people are misled, and that's unfortunate. The product itself, in my opinion, most of it out there is probably garbage. There are some good product that was built on the index annuity that the formulas are clean, the formulas are simple, and you understand what your average rate of return is probably going to be, and it's a good piece for stability and security, but you're not going to get the big home run, and people have got to understand that. But that's why the product was created, in my opinion, that it was trying to fill a void where they saw sales go down on the fixed side, they saw sales go down on the variable side. This fit right in the middle. They thought they could attract both types of investors, yet when you crunch the formulas, bond buyers would be the ones that would be most interested in this, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. The economic article, or the economic reality, as the article ends up, annuities should be considered as long-term investments. The returns and the terms of expectations or return on the expectations of returns should be modified to probably be reality somewhere between 4 and 5.5%. That's basically the range. Certainly they may be suitable for some portion of a person's portfolio, but to use these as the primary foundation should prompt some serious questions. So if you're being approached to basically look at investing and investing substantial portions of your investment portfolios in these products, we would certainly recommend obtaining a second opinion from a qualified planner who may be able to probably insert some common sense into this entire equation. So that's the idea.
Well, I'll just state this. Any product, and I'm not talking about index annuities, but any program, if it is approached to you in that it is appealing to a high level of greed, or it is trying to appeal to a high level of fear, that should be looked at with a jaundiced eye, because in both those cases, now is probably trying to be sold to you as opposed to having true value to you.
And probably overall. You know, I mentioned earlier that we actually had a financial workshop at the office this last week. We had a nice group that was in talking about investment realities and also about the art of investing, how to create portfolios that do well in a wide variety of different types of markets. One of the interesting things that came out of this was the discussion about how long will it take, or how much of a return would I have to obtain that if I've suffered a market loss in some particular period of time in order to get back to my original investments, or if my goal was to, you know, eventually double my principal, especially ramping up to retirement, what I'd have to do. So there's some discussion. It became pretty clear that a lot of people had some fundamental difficulty with understanding some of the math behind this. But just to give our listeners kind of a clue about what happens if your account goes through a market decline, as an example, if the market decline in your portfolio was about 15%, in order to get it back to that same break-even point, your portfolio increase would have to be about 17.65%. If your portfolio was down 20%, to get back, it would take about 25%. If your portfolio is down 30%, it has to come up about 42.9%. So keeping in mind that if you're in a choppy market and if your portfolios are being pounded, you know, down by that environment, then you have to actually get some pretty substantial returns to come back to even. The next question is that if my intent was to accumulate X number of dollars and I'm going to retire, let's say, in 10 years, and we did an illustration about someone who was 55 who had 10 years to go, they had $200,000 to invest, and their goal was to get to $400,000. If their market went through a 20% decline, they're going to have to average about 10.7% every year for the next 9 years to get back to their original goal. So keep that in mind, folks.